Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Mem Aleph Amud Aleph by the two dots. Gemara here is discussing the Mishnah, because in the Mishnah there's an example brought. If an individual says, if my wife gives birth to a Zechar, she'll get a Maneh. She gives birth to a Nekeva, she'll get Matayim. Now, in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with that. A person can say whatever they want. The question really is not about the Mishnah inherently, but why would the Mishnah bring such an example? In bringing such an example, it gives the impression, lememra, debata difale, mi ben, that this person wants a daughter more than he wants a son. He's willing to pay more if his wife has a daughter than if his wife has a son, and that's indicative of some preference that he has. So again, as far as the Mishnah is concerned, it's not an issue because the Mishnah is just giving an example and a person said something. So whatever they said is fine, and that's what you're carrying out. But the fact that that example is brought is indicative of this, a preference for a daughter. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Then we have earlier in the Masechta back on Daf Kut that Zayin, Kol She'enu Meniach Ben Liyorsho, person who doesn't have a son to inherit him, Kadosh Baruch Hu Maleh Alav Evra, Hashem gets angry at him. Shenamar, V'varte Menachlato Lubito, person who passes his Nachala to his daughter, Ve'en Havara Ela Evra. And Havara comes from the source or the word Evra, and that pasuk of Avarte Menachlato Lubito is Ve'en Ein Lo. If he doesn't have a son, and if his nachla is passed to his daughter, that havara derives from the word evra, shenemar yom evra hayomahu. That day is a day of great anger, of wrath, of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So the Gemara says it doesn't seem to make so much sense that this individual doesn't want at least to have a son that can inherit him. And why would he then give preference to a daughter over a son? Now, not to indicate that there's something wrong necessarily with a daughter, but just that we know that it's important to have a son to inherit, and that's what the Gemara says here. Le'inyan Yerusha ben Adifle. You're right, when it comes to inheritance, a person would give preference to a male heir, and that is because, as the Rashbam points out, Tikarei Shema Meit al Nachlato, because then the Nachla stays within the Shevet, within the family, and the land will be known by the Shema Meit of the familial name. And that person will have some sort of memory in the land itself. In those days, we know that land was an important part of the familial estate. You see that by Kerem Nevot. When Achav wants to take Kerem Nevot, he says, I've had this Kerem in my family forever. It's the land of my family. I'm not going to give it up, even to the king. But you see the importance of the connection between the individual to the land and the familial aspects of the connection to the land. Especially in a case where Yovel is being practiced, and then every 50 years all the land returns to that particular Shevet, that particular family. So in that sense, Lini Rusha Ben Adifle. Then the Ben is in a better position to keep it within the family, because if it goes to a daughter, she's going to move the Nachala to another Shevet, to another family. The En Harvacha Bito Adifle. When it comes to Harvacha, give precedence to the daughter. The way the Rashbam explains it, She'ena Yochola Chazer Achar Mizanotea Kezachar. She's not as equipped to go out and make a living like the male counterpart, especially in their day where it wasn't as acceptable for a woman to go out into the workforce and to make a living. So his daughter needs more monetary help because of the fact that she's going to be unable to support herself versus the son that will be able to support himself. The Rabbeinu Gershom says over here, L'inyan harvacha, kishnotein matana, harvacha debat adifale. When he's granting a gift, he would rather grant more to the daughter. Vela yahiv tvei, and to her he gives more mishum diyatvat bebayit, because she lives at home or she stays in the house. Kedichtiv kol kvoda bat melech pnima. Now that is the proper place in terms of tzniut for the woman, not to be out in the workforce, not to be out in the social settings, and therefore he'd rather give her the money so that she can be able to do that and be able to be tzenua and not go out into the workforce. So for both of those reasons, in terms of harvacha, the bat takes precedence. So over here, he's favoring giving the bat more money, not because he wants to have a daughter more than he wants to have a son. It's simply that the daughter will need those funds more than the son will. The son will have the capacity to go out and make a living. The son will have the capacity to go out in general, meaning that it won't be considered a lack of tzniut for him to go out, as well as the fact that his daughter is going to need a dowry. If she's going to attract a good husband, the higher or the more assets she has in her dowry, the more appealing she will be to outsiders. The other possibility here, and I didn't see this in the Rishonim, but the Inyan Arvacha Bito Adifale, which is that the daughter adds, I would say, value within the household, which is that even though the son could go out and work and do other things, the daughter in the house adds hands inside the house, and therefore her Vachad Beito would be from Bat, from the daughter, which is that she's a helper, she's able to take care of the household, take care of the father as well. And we saw before that there is a concept of bracha in the house. The more people that are found in the house, the greater in the bracha is in the house itself. And a bat who's more likely to stay in the house and be a part of the household would then bring bracha to the household. In that way, it would read slightly differently, as you pointed out correctly, that the way we're reading it now is that he's not giving the monetary gift to the son or the daughter because he prefers a daughter over a son, but rather because the needs of the daughter will be greater than the son. If you explain it the way I do, then it would remain in that way, or the original way we thought it intended, which is that he has a preference for a daughter in this situation because of our vacha, that the benefit it brings to the household as a whole. Shmuel Amar, Hacha b'mevakeret askinan. Shmuel does something, and you could come up with other scenarios to do this, but we're speaking about a case where it's a firstborn child, and she's giving birth for the first time, Uchurav Chista. And based on Rav Chista, he does have a specific preference for a daughter over a son. Then Rav Chista, bat chila, siman yafeh lebanim. If you have a daughter first, that is a good siman for having boys afterwards. Ikadamre, the reason being, either demarabi alacha, she becomes like the second mother in the house, and therefore she's able to help out with the subsequent children that come afterwards, so there's a benefit to having a daughter first. Ikadamre, delo shalta be'ena bisha. But the other side of this is that it prevents the Ayin Hara from coming. You can see here in the Rabbeinu Gershom that he describes the Ayin Hara as Hoyel di labat mi ikara, since he had a daughter first, lo limru inshe kama benin itu lulula lahai. People still don't count, and they don't count how many boys did this one have, how many sons do they have. I mean, it's a daughter, okay, yeah, and then they forget about it and they stop counting. Person has a son and then another son, then they start to count, how many boys do you have? Becomes something that affects the Ayin Hara. That's the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom expresses it. If you look in the Marsha, he has an interesting concept here that is specifically connected to a Bechor. Because if you have a firstborn that is a Bechor, he gets a double portion. That double portion creates a problem both from the perspective of the other brothers or the other inheritors in the estate. And therefore there's an Ayin Hara, or they have Kin'ah towards that brother. As well as from outsiders, because then the Bechor also again gets this bonus or benefit that others don't get. And because of that, there's a preference for having a daughter first, because then all the inheritors afterwards are considered to be equal. So that's the way the Marashur explains it in terms of the Ayin Hara, why he might have a specific preference for a daughter over a son in the first place. Or if there are other possibilities that it might be cheaper, then he doesn't have to do a Pinyon Bechor. There are other reasons why a person might want a daughter in particular. For instance, he already has a son, and then he wants a daughter to be mekayim the mitzvah priri rivya. You could come up with scenarios in which the husband has a preference for a daughter. Here, Shmuel gives you that b'vakeret in the case where it's a firstborn child, based on Rav Chista's memra, that it is a good omen to have a daughter first, either because of the protection from the Ayin Hara, or because of the fact that the daughter then becomes the second set of hands in the house, whereby she can then assist the mother with the subsequent children that come afterwards. Amar Rav Chista Uladidi Benatan Adifan Lan Mi Bani. He says that for me, daughters were better than sons. So here we have a cryptic statement of Rav Chista, an unusual statement by Rav Chista, which is that he preferred daughters over sons. The Rishbam doesn't know what to do with this. He has difficulty with understanding where this statement of Rav Chista comes from. He says, Venira Veinai, he says that I have to say here, because there are those that want to suggest it's connected to the previous statement of Shmuel, but it doesn't really fit in, because he says, Lididi, for me. If he was upholding the previous statement of Shmuel and Rav Chista, which is that when you have a firstborn daughter, that's a Siman Tov, so Rav Chista was saying, oh, I also wanted a daughter first, that had been one thing, but that's not what he says here. He says, I have a preference for daughters over sons, which makes it sound like it's a personal thing, nothing to do with the general principle that Rav Chista laid out. And therefore, the Rishbam writes, his children, his sons, did not survive. Kim Banot, only his daughters. He had both sons and daughters, but the sons, it seemingly passed away. And after he suggests that's why he wanted daughters, because his daughters lived longer and survived, and not his sons, the Rashbam leaves it off with, none of this sits well with me. I don't know really why Rav Chisda had this. The Baal Yad Tosafot add on to that and say that actually, throughout Shas, that Rav Chisda has many sons that were Amoraim, and seemingly lived long lives and a part of the Gemara. They're noted many places in the Gemara. He brings a number of children of Rav Chisda. He says he doesn't think that what the Rashbam is saying is correct, but rather he says that he had sons that were Tamidei Chachamim, but his daughters married Tamidei Chachamim that were even greater than his sons. And his preference for daughters were the fact that his son-in-laws were greater in stature than his sons. And therefore he said, I'd love to have daughters because it brought me these son-in-laws who were tremendous Talmidei Chachamim, even greater than those that were my sons. That's the way that Baal Yad Tosafot suggested. Others say simply that he had daughters that were Tzidkaniyot, that they were individuals of special nature, special character. And therefore Rav Chisda says that my daughters exceeded in their righteousness my sons, and therefore he had a preference for daughters. But again, you can see the Rishonim toying or dealing with this issue of why Rav Chisda gives a preference towards daughters when we don't find such sentiments other places in the Gemara. Okay, so now the Gemara says, V'ibai Tema, some suggest Hamani, who's the author of our Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda he, that it's based on the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Hey, Rabbi Yehuda, which Rabbi Yehuda are you speaking about? Ilemer Rabbi Yehuda de Bekol, if you're speaking about Rabbi Yehuda de Bekol, which we saw back on Daf Tet Zayin, which is the Tanya, we had the Braita, Hashem Berach et Avram Bakol, Hashem gave Avram a bracha of Bakol, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Shalai Alo Bat, that the bracha was that he didn't have a daughter, and it's quoted by the Rishonim over there, based on the Sefer Ben Sira, all the difficulties in having a daughter, both in their younger years, their teenage years, and then afterwards trying to get them married, you know, all the difficulties associated with having a daughter. So the bracha that Hashem gave him was that he did not have a bat, according to Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, shahayta lo bat. That the bako, the bracha was that he had a daughter, ubekol shema. And this little piece at the end is an addition that's not found in the other places where this is quoted, where this agadah is quoted, which is that her name was Bakol. Hashem Berach et Avram Bakol. Bakol was the name of his daughter. In the other places, it just notes that Hashem gave him a bracha and everything included a daughter. So the Marsha, back on Daf Tet Zayin, explained that the argument between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda is what is the idyllic state in terms of an individual. Remember that in the beginning of creation, man was created alone. And so therefore, Rabbi Meir views a zachar by himself as being the ultimate bracha. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda says, that was in the beginning. But afterwards, Hashem created the nekeva, that's a derivative of the zachar. And there, vayud basar echad, the man is no longer whole without the nekeva. And therefore, you need a zachar and nekeva in order to have bakol, in order to have everything. So they have an argument in that sense about what is the real bracha or the ultimate bracha between a Hashem Barach et Avram Bakol, was Bakol not having a daughter, the Zachar alone, which was the primary emphasis of creation is the Zachar, or do we say that a Bakol means, no, that once the woman was created, then the ultimate creation involves both a Zachar and Nekeva, and that is the real bracha, is to have Zachar and Nekeva. In addition, the Gemara there continues on to say that the birth of Nekeva gives you the ability to have more individuals to reproduce in the world, and a zachar only can replicate himself, a nekeva can actually carry on and have multiple babies, and so therefore a nekeva has that greater power. So that the Marsha speaks about in terms of the argument here between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. So Imar Dishmaitle the Rabbi Yehuda brata nami lo chasrei rachmona l'Avram. Okay, so Rabbi Yehuda says at least Avram had a daughter. Dadifa mi ben mishmaile. Still doesn't say that it was better than a son. He said Hashem Berach Daram Bakol, that he also had a daughter. Also could be on the equal plane. It doesn't mean the daughter is greater than the son. Elohai Rabbi Yehuda. Must be this Rabbi Yehuda. Detanya Rabbi Braita. Mitzvah lazonet abanot. There's a mitzvah on an individual to provide sustenance, nutrition for his children. And certainly one should do it for his sons who are involved in the learning of Torah, Divrei Rabbi Meir. This goes to the Gemara in Tubot that discusses the fact that a person is really not obligated to provide food, sustenance, and to support their children beyond their very young age. Once you hit 6 or 7, there's really no obligation anymore. There was a Takanat Usha that extended it a little further. But even with the Takanat Usha today, we support our children far beyond what is demanded by the Gemara. And that's what the Gemara over here is mentioning about the Brayta of Mitzvah. That it is, even though it's not an obligation to support one's children, Mitzvah. It's the right thing to do to support one's daughters, and certainly one's sons who are learning Torah. That's Rabbi Meir's view. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mitzvah Lazona Tabanim. Now the Mitzvah is to support the sons, V'kal v'chomer lebanot, and then certainly the daughters. Question is, where you start, and then where is the V'kal v'chomer? The way that Rabbi Meir views it is, you should definitely take care of your daughters, because they're not going to have the wherewithal to do it. And once you're taking care of your daughters, it's a mitzvah to take care of your sons, because your sons are there learning Torah, so it's even a better mitzvah to support them. Or you would use it the other way around. It's a mitzvah to take care of the boys, and certainly to take care of the daughters, and then the Gemara adds in. You can see that until now it was in Hebrew, which means it was part of the Braita. Afterwards it switched into Aramaic, so both the Rashbam and the Rabbeinu Gershom note that this is not a part of the Braita, which is it's a comment of the Gemara on the Braita, to lo litzalan. So that the daughters are not demeaned in any way to have to go out and get their sustenance, whether they have to work or have to beg for their needs. Here, if you provide for them, then they won't have that demeaning experience of having to go out and get their own zanot. So that can't be the answer, because the Gemara is saying that the reasoning by Inharan Rabbi Yehuda there, where he says, Kal v'chomer the banot, is not because the banot are greater than the banim. It's simply that it's much more demeaning for a bat to have to go out and work and to sustain herself, or to go out and have to beg door to door. Because of that, he says it's a kal v'chomer. But you see from this piece of Rabbi Yehuda that he gives a preference to support of the daughter over the son, and therefore he could possibly be the author of that position in the Mishnah that gives a favor of giving larger sums of money to the daughter over the son, for the same reasons that he mentions over here, that it's a mitzvah lazonet abanim and kal v'chomer lebanot. So the kal v'chomer lebanot means that he would give preference or would give larger sums of money in order that they would be sustained. And so we can use that similar thinking to explain why in our Mishnah the person would grant 100 zuz to a son and 200 zuz to a nekeva. Now the Gemara moves back to dealing with our Mishnah from a series of braitot that are now brought from the Tosefta. Elahad Tanya. Yalda zachar v'nekeva. So if he gives birth to a zachar and a nekeva, a zachar notel shisha dinarim, v'nekeva notelet shnei dinarim. The zachar gets 6 dinar. Dinar over here we're speaking as dinar zahav. A dinar zahav is equal to 25 dinarei kesef. So 6 dinarim would be the equivalent of 150 dinarei kesef, or 150 zuz. Remember that a manet is 100 zuz. So in our Mishnah, you had manet and matayim, which is 100 zuz, 200 zuz. Here, he says, if she gives birth to the zachar, she gets 150 zuz. But nekeva, no tell it shnei dinarim. And then the daughter gets shnei dinarim, which would be 50 zuz. B'mai, what is going on over here? So if you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, in the question of B'mai, he says, Komar, heichi mitartze hai milta. How do you explain what just happened in this braita? Da'avdin hochi heichi mifarshin in law. That they did this, and then how do you give explanation for it? La mishum dekashe matnin en la. It's not because we have a question on the Mishnah or our Mishnah or something here. Rather, ela mishum dekol bayi perusha. It needs some sort of explanation. Why is it that you have the individual say that if I have a zachar unikeva, and then all of a sudden the zachar gets 150 zuz, and then the nekeva gets 50 zuz. If he gives birth to a zachar nekeva, the zachar gets 150 zuz, and the nekeva gets 50 zuz. What exactly is going on in this case that would result in such an outcome? And that's enhanced by Tosafot, who says, listen, if you wanted to come up with a case where you gave a certain amount to the zachar, certain amounts in a nekeva, our Mishnah already gave you examples of that. You would use round numbers, like 100, 200. Why are you using numbers like 150 and 50? That sounds like there's something going on here behind the scenes that we're not aware of. So that's what it means, b'mai. Give me some explanation for why the braita sounds like this. So again, it's not a fundamental question in terms of what's this braita doing vis-a-vis our Mishnah. It's more of an internal question about the braita. How do we explain the braita? This braita and the subsequent braita are brought in the Tosefta in the context of our Mishnah. So we know it's related to our Mishnah, but it's coming up with scenarios or outcomes that are different than the Mishnah. So the Gemara wants to understand what exactly is taking place or transpiring over here. The way that the Rishbam explains it is that here we're speaking about Teomim, we're speaking about twins. Even though the Rishbam himself on the Mishnah said that if you say Zachar and Nekeva, that doesn't mean that you meant twins. People don't expect twins. And therefore, if you said, if it's a Zachar, such and such, if it's a Nekeva, such and such, if you have twins, according to the Rishbam and the Mishnah, you get nothing. Because that's not the expectation. When you meant Zachar, Nekeva, you meant Zachar or Nekeva, you didn't mean Zachar and Nekeva. Over here, the Rishbam says, Zachar u'Nekeva means that he was expecting twins. And in expecting twins, Zachar notel shisha dinarim, v'Nekeva notel et shnei dinarim. Again, even in that explanation, you still have to understand why there is 150 versus 50 in this scenario. So I'm Rav Ashi, I'm Rita the Shmaita Kameh the Rav Kana. I said over this memra before Rav Kana, b'misareis. Then the issue is, or the case here, is a misareis. Misareis usually means something that is turned around, flipped over, and over here too. He proposes two different outcomes to the birth of the twins, which obviously you can have twins, you can have a male and female, the male could be born first, or the female could be born first. That's what it means, misareis over here. He stated two possible outcomes, which is damar. Zachar tchila, if the first of the twins is a zachar, matayim, he'll get 200 zuz. Nekeva acharav velo klum. The daughter that comes after him will get nothing. Nekeva tchila, on the other hand, if it is a daughter firstborn of the twins, maneh, she'll get 100 zuz. Zachar achareha, maneh. And the boy that is born afterwards will get 100 zuz. V'yalda, zachar u'nekeva. And sure enough, she gave birth to a zachar nekeva. Now, in their day, it was unlikely that they knew that they were having a boy and a girl. So there are two other possible outcomes, which is a zachar zachar or nekeva nekeva, which he doesn't address. He's only addressing the case of zachar u'nekeva. And sure enough, his wife did have zachar nekeva. The only problem was, v'lo yadinan eminayu nafak bereisha. We didn't know which one was born first. Gave birth, and it was at night, it was in the dark, whatever, nobody was there, and they don't have any idea whether the boy or the girl was born first. Zachar shakil maneh mimanafshach. The boy gets 100 zuz no matter what. Because in either scenario, the father guaranteed the boy at least 100 zuz. In the scenario where he's born second, he gets 100 zuz. In the scenario where he's born first, he gets 200 zuz. So at minimum, he's deserving of 100 zuz. Idach maneh avimamona mutaba safek. The other 100 zuz here is in limbo. Because if the boy was first, he's entitled to that 100 zuz. If the female was born first, then she's entitled to that 100 zuz. Idachman ava mamona mutaba safek. That additional 100 zuz, therefore, is money that is in limbo or in doubt. Vichokim, and therefore you divide it. Now for the Rashbam, that will be the halacha, because according to the Rashbam, we hold like sumchus. And says sumchus says mamona mutaba safek chokim. This is just another example in Shas, where the Gemara seemingly supports the view of Sumchus, and it's more evidence to what the Rishbam says in other places, that the halacha is like Sumchus. The Rabbeinu Tam, the Bali Tosafot disagree and think the halacha is not like Sumchus, and therefore they have to address why over here Mamun Utaba Safek is Chokim. The Bali Tosafot at first say that is only according to Sumchus, but according to the Rabbonon, the din would be a Motzi Mi Chavero Alav Araya. Who is the one who has the Chazaka here that you'd be Motzi from? Says, the natural inheritor here is the son. And therefore, he has the chazukah on the property. So if the woman or the female wants to take money away from him, she becomes the motzi over here, because otherwise all the property would go to the boy or to the son. So that's the way that Tosfot expresses it, that this is sumchus, and the Rabbanan would disagree. But then he brings, inami afilu kirabonan. This could even be according to the Rabbonon, ukma b'chayav, if you just explain it in a case where the father is still alive. It's not post the death of the father where the son is the muhzak in the property. for pre the passing of the father, where the son is not muhzak in the property, and therefore they have equal rights. And even the Rabbanim will agree in that case that it's mamon u'betulah was a fake, and nobody is the muhzak in the property, and therefore chokim. You would split it. There are others who want to suggest that even after the death of the father, that we don't consider it as to be that the son is muhzak in this item, because this isn't considered to be the Yerusha. The father directed this money to someone, and therefore he's not the natural Yoresh of this money, because this money is being held out. It was designated beforehand, and even the Rabbanim would agree even after death, that Chokim. So there are different views here as to whether this is only according to the Sheet of Sumchus, or even according to the Rabbanim, they would agree, this is a Mamon Mutabas Safek, V'Chokim. Ba'atanyo. And now the Gemara brings up an additional Braita. Now, again in the Tosefta, these Braita are back-to-back. So the way that the Rebbeinu Gershom again explains it over here, how do we explain this next case so it's not problematic for the previous Braita? Again, the Gemara is just going through Braita that are associated with our Mishnah and trying to figure out how these cases are differentiated from our Mishnah, not because it's a question on the Mishnah, but just to understand what the Braita mean and what lessons or what information they're giving us. So we explained the first Braita. Now we're on the second Braita. V'atanya yalda zachar v'nekeva. Ain't no ella mane. He gives birth to a male and a female, he only gets 100 zuz. The Rashbam says the focus over here is on the ain't no ella mane. Ain't no ella mane sounds like you should have gotten more, but you were limited to 100 zuz. That means that something was said that should have given you a thought or a havamina that you would have gotten more, but in the end, all you get is 100 zuz. So that was, what did he say that was the case? What exactly is the scenario over here? It can't be the scenario that we had before, because that we just said was 150 and 50. So how do you get to a scenario where you only get 100 zuz? It can't be like our Mishnah, where he stated specifically that they would get 100 zuz, because then that's ein lo ella. Ein lo ella means that you should have gotten more, and not this. In the case of the Mishnah, that's what he stated, and you got what you stated. So what's the case here? I'm a Ravina b'masreini. It's talking about the news bearer. This is an individual who's waiting for hear news about his children. He says, whoever gives me the news about what my wife gave birth to will be rewarded with this. Titanya, we have a braita. If you bring me news about what my wife gave birth to, some want to focus on niftar rachma, that this was a firstborn. He's waiting to find out if this is a bechor or not a bechor, and that's the news that he's awaiting. Others simply say that his wife was giving birth. They wanted to know if she gave birth to a male or a female. What were the children that were born? So in that case, in Zachar, if the person brings me the news that my wife gave birth to a Zachar, ito maneh, then he gets 100 zuz. Yalda Zachar, madnotel maneh. If he brings news that his wife gave birth to a Zachar, we get 100 zuz. Brings him any other news, they won't get 100 zuz. Im nekeva, if he makes the stipulation that if he brings me news that it was a female, maneh, then you will get 100 zuz, yalda nekeva. In that case, again, if she gave birth to a female, notel maneh, then you get 100 zuz. Yalda zachar unekeva. If she gave birth to twins, zachar and nekeva, ain lo ela maneh. You only get 100 zuz for that. So for the Rashbam, the problem here is that he said on the Mishnah that whenever you have somebody specifically state male or female, they do not mean twins. Twins are not in the thought process of an individual who's saying that what my wife gives birth to. So therefore, where on earth did you come up with the fact that they should get anything when it comes to a zechar in a keva? When there are twins here, according to the Rashbam, it should be a zero, because twins are not anticipated. For other Rishonim would disagree with the Rashbam and say that in the case of Zechar in the Keva, you would get both prizes because of the fact that twins then incorporate both what was said by the Zechar in the Keva. Then the question would be here is, why are you only getting a maneh? Why is that the information that you gave not result in a better outcome? How come in the Mishnah they get granted whatever the amount is, Zechar in the Keva? Whereas over here, we don't say that, as opposed to the Rashbam's view, where our Mishnah does not include a case of Teomim. According to the other Mishonim, you would get whatever Zachar Nekeva gets. How come over here, you would only get what one of the two would get? Again, the Rashbam explains the case that he either said, if it's a male, and that was it, nothing else. If it's a female, and then nothing else. And then they had twins, which according to the Rishbam is not subsumed under that statement. For others, it could have been the case where he said, if it's a Zachai, you get 100 zoos. If you get a Nekeva, you get 100 zoos. Then the person comes and says it's twins. For those Rishonim, it should be 200 zoos, not 100 zoos. So, Baha Zachar Unekeva Lo Amar. He never stated or specified anything about twins. So again, for the Rishbam, it means that he never explicitly stated anything about twins, which would have overcome the problem. Whereas for the other Rishonim, it's simply that he only mentioned a Zachar or a Nekeva. He did not mention that it would be a Zachar Nekeva, that you would get both in this case. So the Gemara says, Damar Nami, Im Zachar Unekeva, Nami Ito Mane. So it's a case where he also said that if it's a male and a female, you only get a Mane. So according to the Rashbam, the fact that you explicitly enumerated twins over here would make it that you have the right to collect in this case as opposed to the case of the Mishnah. For the other Rishonim, the fact that you have to mention Im Zachar Im Nekeva is differentiated from our Mishnah. In the Mishnah, even if you mentioned them separately, we assume that you included twins. Over here, we require you to make an explicit statement. And the question then is, why do you need such an explicit statement? And even when you do, why are you only getting a maneh? Why is that the information that you gave not result in a better outcome? According to those which we pointed out before, noted that this is a case of niftar rachma, that this is a case of bichor, then the having of twins over here is not helpful to him. Because he wants clarity as to whether he had a bichor, didn't have a bichor. The news about twins actually does not help him out because he still doesn't know if he has a bichor now because he now has both a zachar and a keva and they didn't give him the information as to who was born first. And given that, he only pays out one because he wasn't looking for the information about the number of children. He was looking for the information about whether it was or wasn't a bichor. Whereas in the Mishnah, that wasn't his interest, and therefore he paid out in Tomim, both for the Zachar and the Nekeva. On the other hand, the Ramban differentiates between the Mishnah and the Braita by saying that the Mishnah is talking about a case where he's granting it to his children. And since, when he's speaking about his children who are close to his heart, then we'll see that later on in the next couple of daf, that a person might grant in a different manner or have a different mindset about giving to the children, so is true in the Mishnah. When he gets news of twins, he's going to give both to the Zachar and Nekeva because he has a vested interest in their well-being. And that's why he, when they are twins, he'll give it to both of them. On the other hand, when he gets news about twins, that may not always be good news for this individual. Either because twins are smaller, they may not survive because they are twins. He doesn't have sufficient means to support twins. So the news may not be as good news as he was expecting. And therefore, over in this case, when he's talking about the person who's bringing him the news, then he only rewards him with the equivalent of giving birth to one child and not both children because the fact that they are twins may not be additional news that is good for him versus the case of the Mishnah where both of them are his children in the end and he wants them to get the benefits of being that child. Although that does leave the question that the Rashbam opened with, which is, then why is the language of here Einon Utel Ele Maneh, that he's only going to get a Maneh? That's exactly what he stated that they were going to get was a maneh, then why is it only ela maneh? So the Rashba does bring down a possibility that the Girsa here should not be itol maneh, rather im zachar nekeva itol, without the maneh modifying it. And that's what it means, the Braita, when it says einu notel ela maneh, is don't misinterpret it to say itol, which means you'll get for each of the children, rather itol means itol maneh, that you'll only get one maneh for both of the children. That's one way to try to at least address that issue, since that was, according to the Rashbam, the original issue of the Braita, which in some senses never gets addressed over here in the solution. So then the Gemara says, Elo lemute mai. Well, then he just covered all the bases. If it's a female, such and such. If it's a male, such and such. If it's a male and a female, then you only get a manet. So what's left over, what news is he going to get besides that? Elo lemute mai, lemute nefel. A case where she miscarried, where there wasn't a viable baby that was born. Others point out that it doesn't just have to be a nephil, it could be an androgynous or a tumtum. We're not subsumed under these languages as well. Those are rarer, but the case of nephil would be something that maybe was more common, and therefore that's what it's the milute, coming to exclude that case. Yes, so he covered all the bases, but he obviously came to exclude the case of nephil. Right now, the Gemara says, how old amar l'debitu, this individual who says to his wife, Nichsai lahai dima'abart. My possessions go to the ubar that you are pregnant with. Amar Rav Huna, Ave Mizakedu Ubar, but Mizakedu Ubar, Lo Kana. So Rav Huna now paskins on this, that he is trying to grant a gift to a fetus, and somebody who tries to grant a gift to a fetus, Lo Kana. The fetus doesn't have the ability to acquire, even though he might exist in the world, he's not a being yet, he's not deemed a halachic recipient until he is born. And therefore, the Ubar can't accept a gift on his own behalf. Now, how this worked over here, according to the Rashbam, is a mazaked Ubar yedei acher, that he gifted it through a third party. He handed it to another party to acquire on behalf of the Ubar. Lo kana ad shiulad. It still doesn't work until the baby is born. It doesn't work. The Baal Yad Tosafot over here disagree and say that the case here is b'shchid meira ayri, dealing with the case of a person who's on their deathbed. You remember on the Mishnah, the Rashbam brought that the case in our Mishnah, which the Gemara is going to quote in 1 second, where he was gifting, and he said, if my wife gives birth to a Zachar, he'll get 100. If it's in a Keiva, she'll get 200. Over there, the Rashbam said, what is the scenario in the Mishnah by which he's gifting this to his children? So he brought two scenarios. He said, either it's a Shechid Meira, and therefore there's a mitzvah to kayim divrei a mate, and there's a mitzvah then to uphold the words of the mate, or to be mikayim what the shchid meira says, or it's a bari that is doing this ayidei acher, through a third party. Many rishonim disagree with the second example that the Rashbam brought. Rashbam, continuing that thought over here, says it's ayidei acher, that it's working on through a third party, and the Tosafot over here conceitedly says that's not the case. The shchid meira ayri, we're dealing with the shchid meira. And he says, even though normally when we speak about the oral transmission of a last will and testament by Shechid Meira, it's the equivalent of being written down and it's given, meaning that we abide by it even though there's a lack of kinyan. Lo mahani mide came into bebari lo mahani afili yedei kinyan. The reason it doesn't work over here for a Shechid Meira is because a Shechid Meira can only do that which a healthy person can do through a kinyan. If a healthy person can do something through a kinyan, a shchid meira can replicate that without the kinyan. But that means it has to work by a bari. And that's exactly what the Tosfot is disagreeing with the Rashbam about, is that if you have a bari, a yedei acher, even if you're mezakeh through a third party, the kinyan doesn't work over here. It will maybe work after the baby is born, but at this point in time, it doesn't work. So if it can't work for a bari, it also can't work for a shchid meira, and that's the nature of the question over here. How is he granting this to the baby or to the fetus if a bari can't grant it to him through a kinyan, then a shchid meira can't, through his instructions, grant it to him? Tosfot then goes on to bring examples of where that's not true. Sometimes where a bari can't do something through a kinyan, we still allow a shchid meira to do it. And then he answers in the end, mikom makom, since it doesn't work by a bari, it doesn't work by a shchid meira, you cannot extrapolate by the dinim of shchid meira. Just because it works in one instance by a shchid meira, doesn't mean in other instances of a shchid meira that it will work. And so he says that the Gemara here is making it clear that you can't gift to an ubar. That means a bari through a kinyan certainly can't do it, and a shchid meira can't do it because the bari with a kinyan can't do it as well. So now we have a problem, which is we're faced with an issue of where there's a failure. Eitvei Rav Nachman, the Rav Huna. And now Rav Nachman poses this question to Rav Huna. After Rav Huna gives us this din with regards to the case that we just brought, he brings our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says the exact same thing, and how are you going to explain our Mishnah? Fine, that's the Psak Halacha with regards to the case that you saw. But once you do that, how do you explain our Mishnah? Omer, im yalda yishti zachar yitol maneh, yalda zachar notel maneh. So she says, if my wife gives birth to a zachar, he'll get 100 zuz. And if she gives birth to a zachar, he gets 100 zuz. Amarlei, mishnatenu eini yodea mishana. I do not know who the author of our Mishnah is. I don't understand how to set up our Mishnah. Not only do I not understand the Mishnah, I don't even know of a dat yachid that could explain our Mishnah. The Mishnah to me is inexplicable because I can't find someone who has an opinion that believes that you can give it to an ubar. So the Gemara says, "Valei malei Rabbi Meiri." Why is it so hard to find an author to our Mishnah? Let us say that it's Rabbi Meir. Damar, Adam makneh davar shelo ba'li olam. Rabbi Meir is of the opinion that a person can give over something that does not exist in the world. Rabbi Meir's din comes from the Gemara in Kiddushin, where he argues on the Chachamim, for instance, about a situation in which a person says, Lishig et gayer. When I convert, we will be married. He gives her kesef kiddushin, or the other way around. He says, when you convert, then we will be married. So Rabbi Meir says, you can generate kiddushin in that manner. Even though the person doesn't exist yet, they have yet to convert, it still is effective. And that's Rabbi Meir's opinion. So why not say the same thing over here? The Rashbam already points out that this question is even more pronounced on Rav Huna. Because the Gemara in Yevamot gives a list of Tanaim and Amoraim who all subscribe to this similar view, which is that a person can acquire Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam. Amongst those members of the list is Rav Huna. That Rav Huna also believes Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam. So now the Gemara says, asking for Rabbi Meir, it's even a sharper question because Rav Huna himself holds like Rabbi Meir by Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam. So some Rishonim argue that Rav Huna and Rabbi Meir don't have the same view in Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam. Even though there's a list of Tanaim and Omoraim over there that all believe that you can acquire or you can grant ownership in Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam, it's not an exact equation of equivalence, is that they have a similar view. They have a similar view, not exactly alike, but they have parts and parcels of that din applied by these different Tanaim and Omoraim. And Rav Huna might disagree with Rabbi Meir with regards to certain aspects of Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam, which would make it that the question is not on Rav Huna as well. Or the truth is that maybe the question is just as sharp on Rav Huna as it is on a Rabbi Meir, but the Gemara is going to give an answer for Rabbi Meir, which is the same answer you would give for Rav Huna. And Rav Huna already was aware of that answer, and therefore the question is coming from Rabbi Meir, and if it was about Rav Huna, it would be the same question, but the answer is the same answer. And therefore, the Gemara couched in Rabbi Meir, because that's who is the Tano who represents this position throughout Shas, about Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam. Tosafot also adds in that Rav Nachman himself should have asked the question, because Rav Nachman himself has the same psak halacha further on in the Gemara. So why doesn't Rav Nachman ask him about his own opinion? How does he deal with it? So the Bali Tosafot give answers on behalf of Rav Nachman, which we'll see in the sugya later on, of how he will explain the Mishnah. But he wants to understand how Rav Huna explains the Mishnah. So Gemara suggests maybe the author of the Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. So Imer Dishmait Le the Rabbi Meir Le Davar Sheyeshno Ba'olam. Wait, it's one thing that Rabbi Meir says that you can acquire or you can gift Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam. But that's only true to somebody that is in the world already. The Davar She'enu Ba'olam Mishmaitle. If the person doesn't yet exist, who says that he thinks that you can make a kinyan? Rabbi Meir's view is that, for instance, in the case of Kiddushin, the person already exists. There's only a status change that needs to take place. They need to go from being a goy to being a Jew. So, shleit gayer, when I convert. Or that when the woman, shetit gayeri, when you convert. The person is there that can take hold of the acquisition. There's some other impediment that blocks it from happening immediately, but in the future. So that, Rabbi Meir says, davar shelo ba'olam, that we can deal with. But when you're dealing with an acquirer that does not exist at all, then Rabbi Meir does not have that view that davar shelo ba'al olam, something that doesn't exist in the world yet, can be passed to a non-existent recipient. If there's an existing recipient and something has to change or something needs to happen, that's fine. Because everything that's needed is there. It's just that we're waiting for some sort of event or future status change to take place. That's fine. But if the recipient doesn't exist, then you can't pass something to a recipient that doesn't exist because the recipient can only receive it once they are a recipient. And so for that reason, we reject Rabbi Meir as being the author of our Mishnah because who says Rabbi Meir's opinion would extend to the case in our Mishnah where you're talking about an ubar, a fetus that is yet to be born. So Rabbi says that's why Rav Huna didn't say Rabbi Meir is the author of our Mishnah because Rabbi Meir may not be able to be the author of our Mishnah. V'leimelei Rabbi Yossi. So let us say that the author of our Mishnah is Rabbi Yossi. Damar ubar kani. Because he believes that an ubar can acquire, an ubar can take possession of something. It's none. Because we have a Mishnah in Yevamot says, Ubar posel veinu machil divrei Rabbi Yossi. That is the position of Rabbi Yossi. So now, as far as the meaning of the Mishnah, Rashi in Yevamot explains the Mishnah in the following manner, which is that a woman who is married to a Kohen, she is an Israelite. As long as she's married to the Kohen, she has a right to eat Truma, because she's considered to be Kinyan Kaspo of the Kohen, and therefore she's entitled to eat Truma. If her husband passes away, she loses that right to eat Truma, Ella imkein, except for if she has a child. She has a child, then her son, the Kohen, grants her the right to continue eat truma even after the passing of her husband, the Kohen. What happens if when the Kohen, her husband, passes away, she is pregnant? When she is pregnant, does the Ubar grant her a right to eat with truma? And that's what Rabbi Yossi says here, according to Rashi, that Ubar eno machil, does not grant this woman the right to eat truma. Until he is born, she has no right to eat truma, because we need a child that exists in order for eat truma. While he's an Ubar, he doesn't grant her that right. The other way around, which is that if you have a Bat Kohen who's married to Israel, the Bat Kohen, as long as she's married to Israel, no longer can partake in the truma of her father's house. Then, if the Israel passes away, then she returns to her father's house and is entitled to eat truma again. If she has children from the Israel, then she cannot return to her father's house, and she will not be entitled to truma. If she has no children, but is pregnant at the time that her husband Israel passes away, that's what it says over here, Ubar Posel, that the Ubar does not allow her to eat truma or return to her father's house. That is the way that Rashi explains this in Yevamot. If that's the case, it has nothing to do with our Gemara, and it's not helpful at all. That's what the Bali Tosfo point out. The difficulty in Rashi's interpretation over there is that it does not fit in this Gemara at all. Then the Rashbam brings the alternate view, which the Bali Tosfo note as well, and seemingly is relevant to our Gemara over here. Which is, one aspect of it is our case over here, which is the Enu Machil. Enu Machil is the case that we mentioned, which is that if the woman who is a Israelite has an Ubar that is from a Kohen, her husband, who passed away, that Ubar will not entitle her to Truma until the child is born. So that's the Enu Machil. The same scenario might also have an impact in terms of what we call Avadim. If the Kohen owned slaves, those Avdei Kenaniim, are entitled to eat Truma because they are Kinyan Kaspo. If the father, or the husband here, the Kohen, passes away, then those Avadim now become the ownership of the children. Now, if they have children, then the children who own these Avadim are Kohanim, and the Avadim will continue eat Truma. If at the time of his death, he left his wife pregnant, then she has an Ubar, and she has maybe other children, or she has no other children, doesn't matter what the scenario is. In either of those scenarios, Rabbi Yossi believes that the Ubar has an ownership in these Avadim. And an Ubar does not have the ability to grant the Avadim the right to eat Truma. So what will end up happening is, if there are other brothers, plus the Ubar will create a blocking of these Avadim from being able to eat Truma. Because if they had been without the Ubar, the children's ownership, who came from a father who was a Kohen, would have granted them the right to eat Truma. But because now she's pregnant with an Ubar, who does not give the right to eat Truma, and he's a partial owner of these Avadim, he causes a problem for these Avadim to eat Truma. Or if he's the only child, meaning that there were no other children, he's an Ubar, then he is going to be the sole owner of these Avadim, but he's yet to be born, and therefore he can't grant Truma. So that is a unique aspect of the Ubar, which is that he does have inheritance while he's an Ubar, but he cannot grant the right to Truma at that point in time. So now we're saying it is Rabbi Yossi who says that an Ubar can be an inheritor when he is in utero. Now that would be a great setup for us. Now we can find someone who is able to take possession of property while they are a fetus, because Rabbi Yossi says the Ubar gets a hold in the Avadim. He has a portion in the Avadim. So then why don't we suggest Rabbi Yossi is the author of our Mishnah? The Gemara says, Shaini Yerusha, Haba Me'eleha. It's very different when you speak about inheritance versus when you speak about a gift. Inheritance happens automatically. You don't need to do anything in order to receive your inheritance. The person who's bequeathing passes away, it automatically comes into your possession. When you give a gift, you need both a grantor and a recipient to be there. So it's one thing for a fetus to be able to be Yoresh, because he doesn't have to do anything. There's nothing required on his side to accept the Yerusha. It happens automatically. On the other hand, when you're talking about a gift, then the fetus needs to accept the gift. The fetus is incapable of accepting the gift, and therefore maybe it's different, even though Rabbi Yossi thinks he's a Yoresh. But he may not think that he's able to receive a gift. So once again, we now remove the possibility of this Tana, Rabbi Yossi, being the author of our Mishnah. So Rav Huna said, I don't know who the author of our Mishnah is. So we suggested it was Rabbi Meir. Gemara rejected that. Suggested maybe it's Rabbi Yossi. Gemara rejected that. So now we're beginning to understand why Rav Huna says, I don't know who is the author of our Mishnah. V'leiba, Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokai. Why don't we say that it is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, who we bumped into numerous times? Damar, lo shna Yerusha, v'lo shna Matana. Doesn't make a difference whether it's Yerusha or Matana. The individual is able to reallocate the Yerusha between the recipients. It's none. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, imamar amishira uili or show dvarav kayamim. That if he says it about someone who is appropriately a first-line inheritor, he can reallocate it. If he has sons, he can reallocate the assets between the sons. So if that's the case here, we could do the same thing with regards to the fetus. If you tell me Yerusha works, so we'll do it under the rubric of Yerusha. So now you have Yerusha that is going to move to the fetus. He's going to reallocate a part of the Yerusha to the fetus, because you said Yerusha can be passed. So in that way, he'll reallocate the assets. The Bali Tosafot point out over here that this may not only be the position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, because even the Chachamim agree, as long as you don't use a Lashon of Yerusha, but rather Lashon Matana, it would work. So maybe we could suggest that it's even according to the Chachamim, although what the Bali Tosafot point out over here is that there was no language of Matana over here, which would imply that it was a form of Yerusha, and that's why the Gemara brought Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Where it says, Imer Dishmaite, the Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, the Davar Shiesh Novolam. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, who says you're allowed to reallocate Yerusha, that might only be about someone who exists right now. The Davar Shiesh Novolam, when you're talking about something that has yet to exist in the world, Mi Amar, who says that he thinks you can reallocate between children when there's a fetus? Who says he thinks that? The Lemele, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, the Savar Laki Rabbi Yossi. So the easy way to solve that problem is to say that it's Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka according to Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi who says that Yerusha does reach a fetus, which is the case of the Abadim, where he gets ownership in the Abdei Knananim of his father, the Kohen. And we'll use Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka who says you're allowed to reallocate Yerusha. You take those positions in combination, then you can come up with a scenario to explain the Mishnah as to how you are granting Yerusha to a fetus. Where it says, Miyemar de Savarla. That's really nice, but you're trying to establish that our Mishnah is authored by someone. So you said Rabbi Meir, no good. Rabbi Yossi, no good. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, no good. So now you're saying maybe Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka holds like Rabbi Yossi. Who says that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka holds like Rabbi Yossi? That's a big assumption for you to make, that you would assume that the authored Mishnah is because Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka not only owns of his own position, but also that position of Rabbi Yossi. We have no evidence of that, and therefore, we wouldn't set up a Mishnah in that manner, because why would you impose on Rabbi Yochanan's position, Rabbi Yossi, when he never said such a thing? Now, it's interesting that the Gemara says that, because in other places, the Gemara is willing to create a position that could possibly be or explain the Mishnah. It doesn't mean that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka necessarily holds like Rabbi Yossi. It might be there's a Tana who believes like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka and Rabbi Yossi in combination. It doesn't mean Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka himself holds like Rabbi Yossi. So you could answer in that way. I think the Gemara feels that we have no evidence of these having anything to do with each other, and therefore the Gemara doesn't see a Tana all of a sudden bringing together two disparate opinions like this. So Gemara says, "V'leimalei b'mafsereini." Why don't we explain our Mishnah as a case as to when he's rewarding someone for bringing the news? Remember we did that with the Braita before. So in our Mishnah, instead of having it going to the child that is born, have it be going to the individual who brings the news. Yochig, the Tani Seifa, that's really nice. It would work in our Mishnah, except for the Seifa of the Mishnah that says, V'im ein sham yoresh elohu, when it's speaking about the Tumtum, if he is the only inheritor, there's no other yoresh besides him, yoresh hakol, then he inherits everything. Ibn Masreini, if you're speaking about the Mishnah's a case where he's rewarding or giving things out to people who bring him news, yoresh mayavedite, then why are you speaking about an inheritor later on in the Mishnah? It makes it sound like the Mishnah is speaking about the recipients over here who are inheritors, not people who are bringing him the news. Because otherwise the second half of the Mishnah doesn't make so much sense. Salemalei bishyalda. Why don't we explain our Mishnah as a case where she's already given birth? So he's gifting it, and it's no longer a fetus because she's given birth. He's unaware of what she gave birth to. He's on a trip. He's not in the room. And therefore he makes the nether, he gives the gift to this child after the child was born. It says, Yochi, again, if you want to say that it would make it work in the Mishnah, except for the fact that Tony Seifa, the latter half of the Mishnah, doesn't meld with that. He says, whatever my wife gives birth to will take it. Then that child takes it. So there again, why is he expressing it as anything that my wife gives birth to? It should be anything my wife gave birth to. Not that anything that my wife will give birth to, but rather it should be anything my wife gave birth to. The fact that it expresses it in the future tense and not in the past tense makes it that you can't explain the Mishnah as being something where, a case where she already gave birth. In the earlier part of the Mishnah, it never mentions whether it was somebody who gave birth already or someone who was going to give birth. He just said, if my wife gives birth to a zakhar, he says, im yalda ishti. So im yalda ishti could be used in both forms. I mean, yalda could be in the past tense, or yalda can be in the future tense when she does give birth. And so yalda could be meaning both directions, both in the future tense or in the past tense. So the interpretation in the first half of the Mishnah is fine. But then when you get to the second part of the Mishnah where he uses language that is only able to be used in the future tense and not in the past tense, which is Amar Koma Shetelet Ishti, over there now you're locked into saying that the Mishnah is speaking about a future case and not a past tense case. And that's the case. We're back to square one is, how is he gifting to an Ubar? Alright, so now the Gemara is going to make alternate suggestions again to explain our Mishnah, but we're going to stop here at the bottom of Kuf Mem Aleph Amud Bet, because those suggestions take us deep into tomorrow's daf.